Welcome to Longevity. I'm your host, Natalie Nittam. I'm a nutritionist, a human potential and epigenetic coach, and I created this podcast to bring you the latest ways to take control of your health and longevity. We cover it all, from new technology and ancestral health practices to personalized interventions and a very special interest of mine, peptides and bioregulators. Enjoy the show. Welcome back to the show, guys. We have an amazing episode for you today. If you're one of those people that happens to maybe be interested in regenerative medicine. So this is the area of medicine where we are pushing the boundaries on how far we can go in helping the body to heal. And it turns out we can go pretty far, according to today's guests. It is just fascinating to me how far regenerative medicine has gotten so far and how few people are aware that you can access these therapies in the United States. So that's what you're going to learn about in the episode. Before we get there, I, of course, want to thank you for being here, as always. If you know anybody else who would get value from this episode, make sure that you share it with them. And secondly, if you're feeling inspired today, make sure that you leave us a review on whatever platform you're listening to this podcast on. And last but not least, remember that natnittam.com is the place where you would go to sign up for the newsletter, learn about the membership community, and also find out about all the different products that I talk about and recommend under Nat Recommends. Today, I get to speak with one of the great minds in this space of regenerative medicine, Dr. Ed Park. Dr. Park has spent nearly two decades pushing the boundaries of how we understand aging and healing. And in this episode, we explore how exosomes, you've probably heard about those, tiny biological messengers are being used to reactivate dormant healing processes in the body. Now, if you guys know me and have been listening to my podcast for a while, you know that anything we can do to reactivate the body's own healing mechanisms is totally up my alley. This is where I think the magic really lies in medicine. And this is the stuff we're getting so much better at. Now, from regenerating ligaments and calming inflammation to supporting stroke recovery and immune function, this isn't just theory anymore. It's actually what he sees in clinical practice. If you've ever wondered whether true regeneration is possible or what might really be driving the results behind stem cell therapies, you'll definitely want to listen all the way through this episode. Now, if you want to learn more about exosomes and Dr. Park, visit rechargebiomedical.com. Dr. Ed Park, welcome to the podcast. Pleasure and an honor to have you here today.
Thank you. I'm really looking forward to it.
We met at RadFest. You handed me your book and you said, hey, I'd love to talk to you about exosomes sometime. Yeah. And I was like, yeah. And then I went into the book and then I talked to a couple of people and then I was like, oh, we need to talk about exosomes.
Let's do that.
I'm really interested. So first of all, I think the first question I want to ask you is, why exosomes? Like out of all, you know, exosomes are part of what I would consider, you know, these cell populations that we access that are native to the human body for regenerative treatments. Hmm. People talk about mucin cells and stem cells and autologous cells and cells that come from amniotic fluid and stuff that comes from the fat and the bone marrow. So why'd you pick these guys? Because these aren't actually stem cells. From my understanding is these are the chemical, these are messenger cells.
Right. So I guess the analogy I would use is the title of my book.
I love the title of your book.
Songs of Healing. So, you know, for a while, I mean, the electron microscope was invented in the 30s. So they knew that cells were excreting these tiny things, but they assumed that they were poop without any real reason. Right. But over the last 16 to 30 years, really 30 years ago, the immunologist, but then 16 years ago, everyone else was like, well, what if they're not poop? What if we're missing something? They started to analyze them because, you know, you can't even see them with an optical microscope. They're below 250 nanometers, so they're invisible. Mm-hmm. When I thaw a bottle, it's invisible. So you need electron microscopy, but instead of poop, if you really go and you melt the capsules of these tiny spheres, you find that they're rich with mRNA, they're rich with protein, and so people get funded to do research on cancer or liver cirrhosis or kidney failure. And they find out, oh, well, if a person has got these conditions, then the exosome population is different, meaning the mRNA and the proteins, the microRNA are different. So they're starting to say, okay, what if we were wrong? What if it wasn't poop? What if this is how cells communicate? And really that makes more sense. You know, like you said, all cells can make exosomes, especially these stem cells that go around repairing stuff. Even plants have exosomes. When you drink raw milk, it's got cow exosomes. So this is kind of a new thing. The last 16, 17 years, people are like, okay, we were wrong about the poop thing. So the question is, why use exosomes? Well, number one, they're too small to have the self-antigens. So you know how if you get like a kidney transplant, your body will try and reject it and you're on anti-immune drugs for life.
Yeah.
These are not packaged with those antigens. So I can use your exosomes, but these come from a newborn baby that was donated pre-COVID, tested for 40 infectious diseases, and the placenta is not even in the freezer anymore. They just isolated the stem cells. So every 3 days, they filter the water out, and they're rich with exosomes. So number one, you can't reject them. Unlike cells, if you take a cell from a person, the MHC doesn't match, so your body will clear them, most studies say, within a few days. During those few days, you're making exosomes, so that's why some people have good results with stem cells. Now, if you go upstream from that, people did PRP. Well, if you've ever done PRP, it's very inflammatory, and in fact, that's what they want. So the premise of that is, well, the inflammation's good, it'll bring in stem cells to release exosomes. But why even bother with the stem cells inflammation of PRP now that we have the final step, which is the exosomes? So they seem to be safe, lack that infectious risk, that can't be rejected. So it's really what you do from a paper cut to a massive stroke, your body's going to release a bunch of non-FDA approved exosomes. So now you can take a dose of that. And a lot of times I'm finding over the last 6 years that it really helps to wake stuff up that's gone to sleep.
Okay. So it's reigniting that the body's own kind of healing systems in many ways.
Yeah. It's like people talk about BPC does this or whatever. We don't really know. That's why I use the analogy of music. Because if you didn't have ears or couldn't measure the waveforms, how would you know how the cells experience this reprogramming? So it's not just one note. It's many notes. It's dozens of, you know, proteins and mRNAs and microRNAs, which block mRNA, that can cause cells that are asleep in your knee, for example. They've copy. Their telomeres got short. Now they can't copy anymore. They're tired. You can get them to do almost like an induced pluripotency, but they get younger, they get de-differentiated, and they can start to try to heal stuff that they gave up on long ago.
We can't isolate and use our own exosomes. We end up having to get them from.
I mean, you can.
Can you? Or how do? What's the, like, why? Like, I'm just curious, right? Because in theory, if we could, like, from what you're saying, if we could isolate our own stem cells, wouldn't they secrete their own exosomes to a degree?
They're doing it now. I mean, we have quadrillions of exosomes probably. But the problem is we all getting older and the cells are getting quiet. And sometimes they're not, you know, able to finish the repair. In a younger person with younger stem cells, more potent exosomes, then sometimes we get back to where we think we should be. But even as a 19-year-old, if you twist your ankle, that ankle is probably not 100% for life. And so as you go through life, you have all these musculoskeletal problems that accumulate. So if you live long enough, 100, 200, 300 years, you're going to need a replacement of everything, you know, because the stem cells are just getting tired and they're getting depleted. But there's a nuanced subtext in what you're saying. If we had the technology to, let's say, find these types of stem cells, one of the guys that spoke was Vince Chiampapa from Costa Rica. So people will pay him a lot of money, like, you know, to get GM-CSF, and he says that for a couple hours, your body will secrete MSCs, which are the mesenchymal kind of traveling doctors, hematopoietic cells, which create blood cells, and endothelial cells. So what he's not doing, which I wish they would, is like Natalie can go in there and get the GM-CSF, they can harvest them, and then some smart people can expand them. They'll take a million and make 2 million, 4, 8, you know, 16 million. You could freeze them, and someday when your immune system is declining, you can go, I have those hematopoietic cells in the freezer. Why don't we just expand them and give me an infusion of, you know,
my own cells.
Yeah, that would be great. Like recharging a phone instead of having a burner phone. So people could do that. They're not doing that. But transiently, when you take exosomes, they can cause the local damage in your knee or your ligament or your brain even to get younger and repair, which is really exciting.
Yeah, that's so basically, so the exosomes are signaling to the existing cell populations to wake up and get to work. They can.
They don't always, but they can. Like, for example,
is that the idea, or does the exosome?
Yeah, no, that is the idea. No, no.
Repair.
Like, for example, if you analyze the contents, and again, we had a competitor to the brand that I use send it to a lab, and the lab said it's normal saline. I mean, they're right; it's normal saline. But why is that? Because the exosomes are packaged in these phospholipid bilayers. So unless and until you melt them with soap, you don't know there's anything in there. Just like if you bought the supermarket toy bubbles, you wouldn't know there's stickers or gum or in there unless you melt them. So you have to melt them, and that's what the scientists have been doing over the last 16 years. And they say, oh my God, it's not random. There's all these factors that will reprogram cells. So yeah, it doesn't always happen, but one of the most rewarding things we do is help people with neurological problems. You know, we've had patients with terrible neuralgias, neuropathy, numb feet, even stroke victims. And so how are you going to repair that? It's not that easy mm-hmm. because the brain is terminally differentiated. There's a couple of things, microRNA 133B, which will allow new sprouting of axons and dendrites. And there's microRNA, I think it's 40A or something, 43A, and it'll cause remyelination. So that's mm-hmm. amazing. That's a repair kit. Usually these things are suppressed, but if you give the microRNA, for some reason, they can act primitive and then start to regrow a brain. Because if you're an adult, you don't want to regrow a brain. That's something for fetuses. But if you've got permanent brain damage, super exciting to get real improvement on stuff that we would traditionally think of as incurable.
Mm-hmm. And so how do you end up targeting, because getting cell, I mean, it, you know, we're kind of jumping around here, but that's okay. I don't mind. Do the exosomes get across the blood-brain barrier? Like, you know, sometimes you deliver something systemically in an IV, let's say.
Yeah.
And, you know, in the body's wisdom, what I've always heard so many people talk about is that these types of cells are attracted to areas of damage because of the chemical messengers and the cytokines and whatnot that are being released at the areas of damage. But how do you make it that, how do you direct them to the brain? Let's say if there's another injury, or let's say the body says, well, actually, you know what? The heart's kind of in really rough shape right now. I think we want it for the heart. And meanwhile, you're sitting there going, but there's a hole in my brain.
No, I mean, it's a good question. So this year in the spring, I went to Australia and they had their annual, I think it's only the 11th annual exosome conference. Mm-hmm. And they raised that question, audience of 1,000 people. And they were 50-50 whether they crossed the brain barrier.
Interesting.
So for people that don't know, you know, the blood goes to the brain, obviously, but there are tight junctions. Just like in your gut, there are tight junctions mm-hmm. Between the mucosal cells. So usually stuff doesn't leak in between. Now, there are certain times, you know, like a baby that's got an inflammatory condition, or if we have encephalitis, that the blood-brain barrier is open, mm-hmm. you know. But they were 50-50. So these are small enough that they can probably squeeze in there and they can piggyback ride. So in answer to your acute injury question, that's usually when it works the best, because they hitch a ride on the albumin, they hitch a ride on the increased blood flow, the leukocytes. So it's really effective in a recent injury. I remember I had gout once. And I injected the gout, but I probably could have just done an IV because there's so much inflammation to that toe.
You injected into the toe? Because I know people who have gout. That's, although I guess when you're in that much pain, what's a little more?
Well, the thing is, you know, my brother, sister, and mom all have gout. And they say it usually takes, you know, a couple of weeks to go away. When I injected the joint, it was gone in a couple of hours and never came back. So it really, it takes you from that inflammatory thing where your body's mounting a response and dissolving the crystals and causing a lot of collateral damage. And it switches the behavior of the macrophages and the T cell system to regeneration. So we get a lot of increased function and decreased pain right off the bat, which is amazing.
That is amazing. But in the case of gout, isn't there some other mechanism of action at play? Like you haven't addressed, like the gout itself is an expression of like it's the culmination of a problem.
Okay. So
is there not a systemic issue that needs to be addressed too, or?
Basically, purines are half of the nucleotides. Mm-hmm. And so if you eat a lot of cheese or meat or whatever, they come out of solution like crystals, you know?
Right.
And so this can be triggered by excess levels, mm-hmm. decreased processing, a cold. That's why the feet sticking out of the blanket is usually where it happens. So yeah, everyone's on the verge of having gout, and if the conditions are right, the crystals will come out. So it's really more a mechanistic thing. It's like having spikes, you know, cactus thorns in your joint. So if you can stop the process that the body will naturally initiate, which is to recruit the active immune system, cause inflammation, manually dissolve the crystals. If you just skip that, like day 1 through 10 inflammation, and go right to the healing, I presume that's why it stopped hurting.
Yeah. No, that's interesting because not everybody eats, you know, just some people get gout. Not all the people get the gout.
They all can under the right conditions. But
and
usually
if you never look at a purine-free diet, it's almost impossible.
No. But ridiculous. The production and also the clearance are the main issues. So, you know, the function of your clearing organs, you know, is important. But it's like instead of blast away the fire and do their hacking and whatever, you just turn off all the oxygen. It's like then the fire would die.
Oh, you stay on fire. Okay. Yeah. Yeah, interesting. Okay, so let's talk a little bit about, we'll talk about four different kind of applications for exosomes and what your experience has been. But I guess, I don't know, no, so let's go back actually to an earlier question, which I may or may not have articulated on the podcast. And that is, and I've actually spoken to a few people who've talked about, you know, when we do a stem cell injection, we're not sure that it's the stem cells that are actually doing the work necessarily, but it might be the exosomes that get kind of that are included in that delivery that are doing the work. Like it sounds like there's still a real lack of clarity around.
Let me clarify. Okay. There was a guy, Arnold Kaplan, who named the MSC, and even the name is problematic, but in my first book I wrote, I guess a dozen years ago, Telomere Time Bombs, I mistakenly said that MSCs go and become whatever you need, you know, different tissue types. Now, the reason that mistake is there is because this is how scientists will prove they have MSCs. They'll give a couple of chemicals, and they can get them to become bone or cartilage or whatever. So Mother Nature probably can do that. I mean, if a scientist can do that, Mother Nature can probably do that. But to prove that with labeling and markers hasn't been the case. So they don't engraft. They don't go there and become that cell type. You know, towards the end of his career, as other people, he said, well, it's really not the stem cells. It's the exosomes that they're making that is affecting the local niches. So to answer your question, you really probably, if you're being honest, don't need the cells. Cells are great. They produce it well before your immune system kicks them out and destroys them. Mm-hmm. But it probably is the exosomes that are doing the heavy lifting.
Interesting. Okay, cool. All right. So let's talk about exosomes for example, musculoskeletal issues. I know that you in your, I mean, why don't you talk a little bit about the different types of treatments you do in your practice? There's all these tissues that are notoriously difficult to heal. So things like tendons, ligaments, like these tissues that don't get a lot of blood flow, even things like cartilage, the meniscus in a knee, like these are injuries that people sustain that are just a pain. And then sometimes they get surgery and half the time, like I know someone who literally tore an Achilles and it took 3 rounds of conventional treatment and finally a tissue graft to actually get him to be back on his feet again. So, you know, in his case, clearly his body didn't have the capacity to heal itself.
Well, okay, so it's a good point. So let's take the meniscus, for example. My 21-year-old tore his meniscus, and so it was painful, clicking. We treated it. It got much better. After 2 injections, he said it was 100%. I just gave him a third treatment after almost a year. So he's good. The usual course is that unless you're like a 12-year-old, still young, a lot of vasculature in your knee, they're going to just cut it off, which is fine because there's not a lot of blood supply. It's white. It's not pink or red. So there are workarounds for that. They can drill holes in the cartilage or blah, blah, blah. But basically, they usually don't sew it. Mm-hmm. Because the stitches don't heal, they don't get absorbed. It's a nightmare. So your point is well taken, but we have to step back. I mean, we are machines that self-heal. We're houses that self-carpenterize. But the problem is that the stem cell quality is getting poor. The number is getting depleted. There's epigenetic silencing. So we have to introduce the concept of osis, not itis. So itis means inflammation, you know, whatever, pharyngitis, tendonitis, and arthritis of the knee. And I remember one of our colleagues taking training, she was like, I tap a lot of knees, she's a rheumatologist. She said, but there's never any white cells in there. It's not inflammation. And it made me think, well, okay, this is what they're teaching us, that we're talking about osis, arthrosis, worn down, tired, not even trying to repair. And the same thing can happen when the stem cells get old in your rotator cuff. If you scan men over 80, like half of them have disconnected rotator cuff muscles. They have tendinosis, not tendinitis. So the traditional therapies of steroid, well, maybe you have an itis, it would help. But if you look at all the Cochrane review studies on joint injections, and I'm in the process of doing this for my provider training course, it's the evidence is very weak that it's helpful longer than a few months at only low doses. But physiologically, steroids can be toxic to those tissues. They taught us when we were doing the tennis elbow, you know, beware, a lot of times you'll get an elbow rupture of the tendon. So I think, you know, that it, historically doctors want to do something to alleviate pain, but it maybe wasn't FDA approved. It wasn't scientifically based. It's just anecdotal. And in the long run, it may be a setup for worse damage. So at least for my 21-year-old, you know, most people that get a meniscal resection, their pain goes away, but the alignment is not as good. So it's like a mortar and pestle. So over the long haul, it's a setup for arthritis. But if we're being honest, if we live to 180, we're probably going to get arthritis of everything because of stem cell depletion and wear. So it's not just your friend had bad. I mean, there's things that can make it worse. You know, certainly there's autoimmune rheumatoid diseases that can make it worse. But it's just a natural part of getting older. If you have a car, I don't care how great it is. If you drive it for too long, stuff is going to break down.
A friend had a flap tear on a meniscus and she was advised. I mean, she went to see an orthopedic surgeon. He's like, okay, let's operate. Let's do it. You know, whips out his knife and says, let's cut that bugger out.
Yeah.
And then when she went talking to people more in the regenerative space, they advised her not to operate, that there are better, it's at least not right out of the gate. But they felt that.
You know, there's no absolutes. Like I tore my meniscus, I'm going to say 14 years ago. And I took the TA65 telomerase activator. And so it was okay, but it was still clicky. It still hurt occasionally. But then once I tried the exosome 6 years ago, it's been quiet for 6 years. So the explanation there, I think it probably repaired it. I had a doctor, OBGYN. She had convinced a surgeon to give her sutures to repair her torn meniscus. But that was so painful because the permanent sutures, the proline, were clicking and hurting. So for whatever reason, we gave her injection and she was able to complete her Eagle Scout hike with her daughter this summer, which was a big goal for her. So the thing is, in my experience, you know, over 2,500 injections, we do a lot of joints, usually about 60 to 70% positive response. And by about 5 weeks out, you know where you're at. So if somebody has had PRP and it's worked, I can almost guarantee the exosomes will work too. But then again, if you're just like too little too late, like you're bone on bone and you're 80 years old and, you know, those stem cells are not even respondable, then it's probably, you know, knee replacement that you're heading towards.
Right. So that was going to be my next question is who shouldn't do this? Like who, you know, when you say 70% success rate, so who's the 30%? Do we know do you have a sense of who, I mean, you probably don't have a perfect sense in the sense that you would then just tell those 30% don't bother and then you'd have 100% success rate. But there seems to be some.
Well, in that 30%, it's probably only 30% of 30%. But it's attribution bias. It's expensive. And they don't want to do it again. Mm-hmm. So if you ask those 30%, did you get it all better? Probably at least half of them would say, yeah, it got a little better, but it wasn't enough.
Yeah.
So you could say, well, you know, was that a failure? Maybe it was, maybe it wasn't. I had one very wealthy guy who I treated his shoulder for a rotator cuff. He said it only got 25% better. So I was thinking, well, maybe you could do it three more times and you'd be fine. But, you know, his preconceived notion was if it's not one and done, then it didn't work. So there's attribution bias. Yeah, I mean, if you take in your brake pads to a guy to get them resurfaced, and you only have 30 minutes and you have only $100, maybe he's not going to be able to do the whole brake pad.
Yeah.
But people sometimes don't see it that way.
What if boosting your energy wasn't about more caffeine, more supplements, or more hours in the gym, but about supporting your body at a cellular level? Look, over time, our cells accumulate damage and their ability to generate energy declines. And that's because your mitochondria, those little energy factories in your cells, get damaged and slow down over time. So this is why you might feel more fatigued, struggle with endurance, or even take longer to recover after exercise. MitoPure is a breakthrough supplement that promotes cellular renewal of mitochondria. It contains urolithin A, which helps your body clear out damaged mitochondria and create new, efficient ones, giving you more sustainable energy. Unlike other supplements, MitoPure is clinically proven to enhance mitochondrial function and slow age-related cellular decline. With regular use, you'll feel the benefits: more endurance, improved strength, and faster recovery. I've been taking MitoPure for almost 2 years now, and I can say that I have never felt better at the gym. My energy is consistent, and I rarely get sick, because guess what? Those mitochondria are also super important for your immune system. And so if I even do get sick, it just seems that I kick it faster than pretty much anybody else around me. Now, Timeline is offering 10% off your order of MitoPure now. Just go to timeline.com/nat10. That's timeline.com/nat10 for 10% off. Okay, so in your book, you also talk about immune cell populations that benefit from exosomes, right? That are positively influenced. And so is that the kind of work that happens when people are doing an IV of exosomes? Because there's different applications of exosomes. You have people who do IVs of exosomes. Then we have people who are going to have exosomes injected, as you've been talking about, into a joint or into an area of injury.
Right.
We talked about the brain where, you know, we're kind of hoping that, you know, if there's enough damage in the, like, for example, if somebody had a stroke, is there research around stroke victims and exosomes? Because if part of the brain.
No, it's all anecdotal. But when they do mouse experiments, they use human exosomes. They'll tie off the carotid artery or what have you, and they'll give half the mice exosomes from humans and half not. So the recovery from that is better. The residual damage is less. Same with heart attacks. Same with mangling a mouse's knee. So this stuff seems to work. You know, obviously when you're talking about, and I do treat a lot of neurologically damaged people, you have to measure the expectations. You have to let them know, you know, if you've got advanced Alzheimer's, you're probably not going to fix everything. Yeah, you may be able to mitigate. Specific areas of damage may be sometimes easier. Isolated nerves like Bell's palsy, we have a lot of success, even trigeminal neuralgia. So, but if you think about like advanced Alzheimer's, it's probably like a burned down house. That's not that easy to just...
Right. Well, with advanced conditions like that, for sure. I mean, it's neurodegeneration. So things have been breaking down for a long time.
Yeah, but it's a process. Like, you know, if you get better sleep, maybe this TB006, Galactin 3, antibodies helpful. You know, the brain can regenerate. But again, well,
there's
a
many
lot of
different
times,
steps. Yeah, yeah. Like there's different areas. I mean, you've got, I don't know if you're familiar with Dr. Dayan Goodenow's work with plasmalogens, but that would be another piece of the puzzle where you're bringing in precursors of elements that actually help to rebuild myelin sheaths or rebuild cell membranes. And that's another, it's like another piece of the puzzle.
I know his work and it's compelling, but you know, it's like if you bring a bunch of nails and 2x4s, that doesn't mean you can actually fix a house that's completely trashed.
But that's what I mean. It's they're going to be able to do some of the work. The exosomes might be able to do another piece of the work. Like the
magic can lie
in all the things coming together.
But you know, you have to be realistic about it. You know, listen, you chop off a salamander's leg, it'll grow back. Mm-hmm. Why? There are a lot of reasons why, but you know, there's probably a lot we don't understand, not only in the messaging and the dedifferentiation. But I saw this great Royal Academy lecture about biomorphogenic fields. I don't even know what it means. But if you think about it, there's got to be some internal electrical or some other logic as to why a salamander foot is a salamander foot. Mm-hmm. And so there's a level of understanding and theory that is not even accessible to us as to how the cells organize and communicate. So if you're trying to rebuild a brain after a stroke, like all that stuff that just happened naturally by in utero programming to grow your brain from a little tiny fetus, like, is that really accessible? Can you recreate those conditions? I don't know.
Well, not right now. And I think to your point, there's, I don't know if we want to call it metaphysical, but there's something beyond the just sheer biomechanics at play that right now kind of eludes us. And there's people exploring in that space, but you know, who knows how long it's going to take and if ever we're going to get our heads around it really. So where I was going before, when I nicely interrupted myself, which I always prefer to do than interrupting the guest, is talking about the immune system. So an aging immune system ultimately is, it's going to take us out. That's going to be the thing.
100%.
It takes us down. So within that space, and you talk a lot, you talk in the book about, you know, macrophages and T helpers and CD8s and CD28s and all this stuff. How, where, why, what's the process of using exosomes to support immune, a better immune response?
Yeah, I don't know that I have an answer for that. I will tell people that if you pick up the book, you'll understand what we're talking about. So something you're alluding to is about 6 or 8 years ago, they did a study on a Dutch lady. And she only had two types of naive T cells. So naive T cells are ones that can respond to a new threat. Whereas a young person will have 10,000 blank keys. She only had two. So it's quite true. I blogged years ago about immune senescence. We used to measure it in the CD28 positive cells. But like Jack Lane didn't go to the hospital because he's like, my body's perfect. I'm good. Common cold took him out. So basically, you're exactly right. The naive T cells, the ability to respond to new infections, but also to cancer, because people don't know or don't realize that you probably have gotten cancer many times and that your body's primary mission is to clear that. And it does it. And, you know, the cancer cells kill themselves. So we've been sold this bill of goods that cancer is rare, it's genetic. It probably isn't either of those things. But there are many ways to cure it. But the point is that your immune system is very, very important. And it just, because of the arrow of time, the depletion of stem cells, like you start out life as just one cell, one fertilized egg. And throughout the course of time, all these stem cells in your kidneys, your knees, your brain, everywhere, your bone marrow for the blood, they're getting depleted, they're getting mutated, they're getting old. So that's really what aging is. I don't want to depress people, but you can read the book and figure out. I mean, if you want to learn, we talked about the exosome book, my first telomere book. Because for 17 years, I've been taking this telomerase activator, and it's kept, you may have seen a little thinning, but still black on top at 57, and reading glasses I don't need. So for 17 years, no reading glasses. So Hay House paid me to write this book, Telomere Miracle. So I don't even think it's in print anymore, but we talk about all the science around natural stuff that you can do for $0 and 0 cents, you know, how to breathe. We talk a lot about sleep architecture, movement, diet supplements, even your thoughts and breathing. So these are all things that you can master and hack and just get tremendous benefits, both in the quality of your life and probably in your longevity too.
Yeah. Well, it's so interesting that, you know, at the end of the day, it always comes back down to these pillars, right? It's the free, if you're not doing the free stuff, all this fancy, crazy, expensive, you know, advanced regenerative stuff.
Yeah.
It's almost like you haven't got the soil for things to take root.
I mean, it's just mind boggling. You know, they should teach kids, prison inmates, like deep breathing, meditation, yoga. I mean, how much more happy would we be as a culture if people knew how to self-regulate, but they just turn to like dopamine triggers and addictions and. It's pretty messy out there.
You know, the social media, this whole, I don't know how we'll ever break out of it or move past it. It's hard enough on adults, but for little kids, I actually find for small children and also for elderly people, it's a vortex that they fall into. Like, you know what I mean? Like they can't get themselves out. Like with small children are, It really, the responsibility falls on parents to really be mindful of how much exposure they're getting to this stuff, because it is designed to be addictive. And those little brains just.
There was that great documentary on Netflix, The Social something or other, 4 years ago. Mm-hmm. But all the tech execs wouldn't let their own kids have the devices.
Yeah.
So that should tell you something.
Yeah, no, for sure. In the book, you talk about some, you have some discussion around blood pressure. And I know that, again, like some of the other people I've spoken to really talk about how when there's cardiac damage, which is not necessarily a blood pressure issue, but it's part of the same system.
Yeah.
Cardiac damage responds really, really well to even stem cell infusions, like targeted stem cells. And I'm guessing that exosomes are going to fall into that space. Has there been work done around that? Because, you know, talking to people, you're almost like, geez, you know, this should almost be standard of care. When somebody's had a cardiac event, there's been significant damage to the cardiac muscle. And I would imagine that if you get at it soon enough, it's a little bit like you were talking about with advanced Alzheimer's versus an acute injury.
Yeah.
If you can get at it soon enough, immediately after the event, you might be able to mitigate, if not reverse, a lot of that damage.
I mean, that's what the mice studies show. I mean, you intentionally give a mouse a heart attack, and the ones you give stem cells or exosomes or both, they do much better. They lose less heart. So based on ethics, if it wasn't a matter of like who gets ownership or who takes credit, it's probably something that if money were not an object, yeah, I agree. People should get it. Anytime you're acutely injured from anything, it's how your body's trying to do its thing. So if you give orders of magnitude more, you probably heal more efficiently. Because remember, the healing state is not the baseline state. Usually we're just in maintenance.
Yeah.
So when the inflammation comes in, you're trying to coax these old cells to act young and act like a in utero repair growth thing, you know, the more signal, the better in most cases.
Mm-hmm. And then when you were talking about nerves, I mean, this is going to end up a little bit more rapid fire than I might have hoped. But when you were talking about nerves like trigeminalgia, I used to know a woman who suffered miserably.
Oh, yeah.
The trigeminal nerve is a major nerve in the face. And when it goes, and in this case, she just lived in perpetual pain.
Oh, yeah.
Nothing would touch that pain. Are you talking about hydrodissection into the nerve with the exosomes, or are you just?
No. So about a dozen years ago, I met a doctor. She liked the lecture I gave on telomeres. And she and her colleague took me out to dinner. And then 2 years ago, in some serendipity, her nurse saw my lecture on exosomes at the big conference. Said, hey, doc, you should try this, because a year earlier she had sudden onset of trigeminal neuralgia using a harmonic scalpel. It must have just lit it up. She had a history of traumatic brain injury. So one nasal treatment and it was gone. It's been gone for almost 2 years now.
What do you mean nasal? Like nasal spray?
No, submucosal in the nose. So it must have trickled up through the olfactory nerves to Meckel's cave where the trigeminal ganglion is and just remyelinated or fixed it. Whatever. She was like suicidal. Like you said, the things that hurt the most, we're taught, are corneal abrasion, rotten eye tooth. It's because they're so highly innervated that you just want to die. So that was an amazing thing that I'm so grateful for, because you know, she's a very productive member with children and she needs to stay alive. But yeah, multiple sight wounds and just the terror.
Well, and beyond that, like it offers a possible solution to people who are told by the system there's nothing for them.
Well, I mean, the system doesn't know yet. I mean, if we have like, I've had 3 out of 3 people with trigeminal neuralgia get better, that's a pretty good batting average. So if you're looking at a 0% chance of success versus, you know, maybe you'll get better, it's an asymmetric risk, but one that anybody with that condition would gladly take.
Oh, they would. I think they would take their last penny to get out of pain and then worry about making more pennies on the other side of it, kind of thing. So what about things like peripheral neuropathy, which is maybe a little harder to target, I'm going to guess. Is that the kind of thing that you've seen?
Yeah, we've seen some help. I mean, my personal results, you know, are not as good as I would like. But, you know, there's one exception, Bob the Builder, we called him, but he was a bodybuilder, really nice guy, great guy, but tall guy, had some exposures, and it was progressive neuropathy. He had ankle-foot orthotics, but all that's a thing in the past now, so he's able to feel more. Listen, his calf muscles haven't really come back to where they should be, but he still walks a couple miles a day. and doesn't need orthotics. So that's at least moved the needle for him.
What were the exposures that caused him to develop this? Do you know?
I forgot, but I know some people have like pesticides, Agent Orange. I think it may have been.
So it's a chemical exposure.
Steroids. You know, some people with using excess testosterone get it.
Interesting.
Also, being tall is a risk factor. Diabetic, although he was not diabetic.
Yeah, so diabetes is known for neural. And so in that situation, is that a systemic application?
For me, used the ultrasound to find the nerve bundle. And I guess you called it hydrodissection, but you just inject around the sheath. And you can see the nerves being surrounded by a halo of black fluid. And I guess, you know, basically, if you think about it, the nerve runs from the spinal cord all the way down to the toes. So anywhere along that, it can kind of help to mitigate. But mm-hmm. These are all like Hail Marys. You know, it's amazing that we even can do that. It's what your body would do normally. Like, you know, I just treated a lady with Bell's palsy. And 4 months later, she's basically normal. Half her face was paralyzed.
Wow. And you how know, long was she paralyzed for?
Just a few months.
Okay. Like, so with a Bell's palsy, someone who's been paralyzed for 30 years, you wouldn't expect the same result? Or do you have experience on
that's,
that?
Yeah, that's where I was going with that. Like, I had a lady who had 10 years of Bell's palsy, and it did go away. So that's really? My point. If you have osis, like, it's not really a word, neurosis. Well, that's kind of like
no, because
thinking
that,
about
that
your mom.
Is mental, yeah.
So we do occasionally get, like, success with that, which is amazing. So, yeah, I don't know why, but some people do get better.
That's
but I like to put it in general because, you know, one of the first people I treated his knee, right? It's going to leak out. Some people like binders or whatever to keep it in the knee. I don't know. But his thumb started hurting on day 4. He's like, "Doc, why does my thumb hurt?" I go, "I don't know why your thumb hurts." The reason why is it leaked out of the knee and got to his thumb, and he had jammed it skiing 10 years earlier. So, you know, that often happens. Like, things that stop trying to heal will just finish up. And so his thumb got better. So,
and the healing process was just reawakening the discomfort, basically.
We presume, like, there are songs that I don't understand, but the cells understand them. They act younger. They start to repair. But the point is, like, if it's an old injury, I do like to get close to that nerve or close to that knee or that tendon. If it's acute injury, I remember one lady fell from a horse, broke 5 vertebrae, but she was deathly scared of the epidural that I recommended to her. So she just did an IV, and, you know, within 2 weeks, she was 100%. So the point is, like, I mangled my ankle a year ago. It was purple, red, swollen, IV. Because the immune system, the white blood cells are going there, you don't really need to localize it as much if it's an acute injury.
Right. It's the area is screaming. It's sending out all the chemical messengers. Like, the whole body has its attention turned there. Yeah. That's so interesting. Okay. Well, listen, I know that you have to catch a plane. So why don't we, I mean, unless there's something else that you wanted to talk about that we haven't touched on.
I think the placebo effect is important. You know, people who are looking to find, like, no result have worse results. It's just attribution bias. So anytime somebody wants it to work, it works better. But is it just pure placebo? There's no way. I mean, the things like I've seen over the last 6 years are just inexplicable.
Yeah.
So if people are interested, they can pick up the book. They can sign up for my weekly newsletter. We talk about anecdotes. It's also audiobook. So at rechargebiomedical.com, they can get onto my weekly newsletter. Mm-hmm. Right now I'm in the process of doing provider training, which is like, we taught the doctors how to do the IV, the nasal, the knees, the hips, next week the back. So we just, if they're a doctor or a provider, nurse practitioner, they can join my course. And that way they can download the protocols, watch the videos, and it's 12 hours of 20 lessons on their own time. Okay. Other than that, I practice in 6 states. I live in Cali. I go to San Fran a lot, Utah, New York, Florida, Texas, and Hawaii.
Wow.
And I train docs sometimes if they have friends and family.
Do you treat patients in all those places?
Yeah.
Okay. And then what's your website? Like, if people want to find the book and or find your courses.
Yeah. So it's www.rechargebiomedical.com. And on YouTube, you can subscribe to my channel, which is DRPARK65.
DR.
PARK 65, yeah.
65. And that's YouTube.
Yes, ma'am.
All right, sir. Well, a pleasure to talk to you. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And have safe travels. And I hope that we get to do a part two at some point down the
Absolutely.
Road.
Absolutely.
Thank you.
Absolutely. Thank you. Bye, everyone.
Bye.
Hey, folks, just a quick reminder that all of the information presented in this podcast is for information purposes only. No medical advice, no diagnosing, no treatments suggested here. Before you try anything that you hear about or learn about here, make sure that you check with your medical provider.